Greetings, Blogging Heads viewers. My name is Bill Butler, and longtime viewers of Blogging Heads may remember me, although you would certainly be forgiven for not. I used to appear as a fill-in occasional guest on the weekend blog. The show is now called the DMZ. And earlier this summer, I reached out to Robert and the rest of the Blogging Heads team and suggested that perhaps Blogging Heads consider covering technology in a way that it's not now. So this is a bit of an experiment. We have one show here. We'll see if this goes well. I think technology, both tech policy and tech business, are very interesting to me, and I think they will be are to the Blogging Heads viewers as well. We live in an era now where technology, it shapes our lives in ways that it never has before, in ways good and bad, and so I'm interested in exploring all of those. So the idea that we have here, we'll give a try, is I will invite on technology journalists to discuss both issues in the news and things that they are covering as well. So joining me for this potentially first edition is media and technology journalist Simon Owens. Welcome, Simon.
Hey there. Thanks for having me, Bill.
Thank you. Would you like to give just a brief biographical sketch for folks
about
who you are?
Sure. I've covered technology for a long time. Started as a newspaper journalist for the past few years. I've covered it for, U.S. News and World Report, freelance for The Atlantic, The Next Web, Harvard's Nieman Lab, PBS's Media Shift, and I've lived in Washington for a long time, so I've definitely worked on kind of the boundaries of policy and tech, for companies ranging from Comcast to Google to Intel. So this is definitely a subject that's near and dear to me.
Excellent. And I suppose by way of full disclosure, we should say that, you and I have known each other for a long time. We're friends and we have worked together as well. So
yes. In fact, you're the reason that I am in Washington, D.C. You recruited me to a tech marketing firm back in 2008.
I plead no contest. There's more than a grain of truth to that. Okay. Well, I think folks know who we are now, at least a bit. And let's get started talking about what I think is one of the, and it's not one story, but this is a confluence of several interesting stories right now. So let's begin with Jeff Bezos at Amazon, who is one of the more fascinating figures of our time, who's just bought the Washington Post. And you and I were talking about this a few days ago, something you pointed out to me that I was not aware of, and that is that Amazon's Web Services is currently looking to contract, potentially about the contract, with the CIA, which raises some interesting privacy concerns. You want to give a little more background on that for us?
Yeah, I mean, the thing with Amazon Web Services is Amazon really, years ago, really started investing in the cloud. It had this huge website that was going to need to have this huge capacity, so it just started investing tons and tons of money in data centers. And this is probably one of the key reasons why Amazon has always had kind of razor-thin profits, is because they've spent so much time investing in the future. So they ended up having way more cloud computing capacity than they could ever dream to use for just Amazon.com. And so they basically became a cloud services company called Amazon Web Services, and probably one of their most famous clients is Netflix. Netflix decided not to invest in its own cloud infrastructure and basically built it all on Amazon Web Services. But one thing that not a lot of people know about is that Amazon Web Services is very involved in cloud computing for the government. And in recent months, a few months ago, there were revelations that it actually is moving into a space that in previous times Jeff Bezos had poo-pooed in saying he would never want to get into, and they won a contract, a massive $600 million contract with the CIA to do cloud computing for them. And the reason why I say this was something that you never would have thought that they would have gotten into is because they're actually building the cloud computing services on the servers on site. So rather than just having them in their data centers, it's going to be a data center that the CIA has complete control over, has complete security over. So they're basically building it kind of in-house from the ground up.
Does that really make it cloud services at that point? If it's entirely self-contained within a CIA data center, like how is that Amazon?
I mean, this is a little bit beyond my technical expertise, but but obviously they're going to be facilitating all the technology. It's still cloud computing because everything's going to exist in the cloud. It's just going to be, you know, a private cloud that's more secure than the cloud that you and I are used to when we're logging into Google Drive or whatever.
Okay. You know, and we're recording this on a Wednesday here. Just yesterday, there was new developments in this. So I think that contract was, as you say, it was actually revealed before it was really announced. It was originally published in a publication that I'm not too well aware of. But it took Amazon and the CIA a little while to acknowledge, yes, we do have this, you know, we are doing this. And then, interestingly, IBM raised hackles over this. Because I guess this is a lot more what IBM has been doing ever since they sold off their, you know, computer manufacturing to Lenovo. IBM has really been doing IT services and the cloud services for companies. And so they complained to the GAO, right? And then, so yesterday, so the GAO looked at this and they resolved that the way it broke down was IBM had the lower bid, but Amazon had the technically superior bid. They nonetheless recommended that the CIA go back and review this decision. And so what happened yesterday was the CIA, there was a new revelation, and those were the details of Amazon's lawsuit against the CIA, trying to keep them from reopening it. And so that's what we just found out yesterday. Go ahead.
Well, it's just interesting because they have to do this kind of it's this public / private battle where, you know, the revelation wasn't supposed to be made at all that Amazon had had won this contract, and now it's having to kind of pitch this battle with IBM where it can't reveal too much, but at the same time, obviously there are leaks being made. So once the cat is out of the bag, then they have to defend themselves. So it's definitely a kind of catch-22 scenario where they do want to try to defend themselves, but can't do it too much because obviously this is the CIA we're talking about. So it's definitely creating an interesting dynamic where we as outsiders are trying to parse what is going on here and I think all sides are kind of frustrated, I'm sure, from this from this debacle.
I mean, speaking of being outsiders trying to parse things. Let's take it back to something I mentioned just a few minutes before about the fact that Jeff Bezos has recently purchased the Washington Post for $250 million, which to me sounds like a heck of a lot of money, but I guess is about 1% of his net worth.
Yes.
And granted, it was Bezos that bought the Post and not Amazon, although that's been a point of confusion in some of the reporting. I mean, is this a conflict of interest for him to both be doing work, highly sensitive work for the CIA, and then also owning a newspaper who's one of its beats in the, you know, the local area here is the CIA over in Langley.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is something that we're seeing as a lot of these family dynasties that own newspapers are basically selling their newspapers. It used to be the Bancrofts with the Wall Street Journal, then it was the Grahams with the Washington Post. Basically, the Sulzbergers are pretty much the only ones left with the New York Times. And you know, every time a billionaire buys a newspaper, there's a reason that they're a billionaire. They made their billions of dollars somewhere. So there's going to be some kind of industry in which the journalism that newspaper is covering intersects or has a conflict with whatever financial interests are for the person who you know, who bought them. And in this case with Amazon, with Bezos, there are a lot. And let's be clear here. He's not just, he's basically, you know, the founder of Amazon. So even though it is that they are, two separate entities, they're in many ways synonymous. You know, Bezos has Amazon running through his blood. He's integral. He's very integral to that company.
He's the largest shareholder. Largest shareholder. He is its visionary. Yeah, you're right. He is very, very, very closely associated with that company in a way that, you know, latter day Apple was with Steve Jobs.
Yeah, and I wouldn't begrudge people for confusing the two or conflating the two whenever they're discussing the conflicts of interest between Amazon and whatever his goals are with the Washington Post. But at the same time, there's always this idea of whenever someone buys, there's always this speculation when someone buys a newspaper, how much intervention, how much editorial input is there going to be? The most famous case was when Rupert Murdoch bought the Wall Street Journal because, you know, Rupert Murdoch had been well known prior to that for calling up newspaper editors for newspapers he owned and pressuring them into changing their coverage. And ever since the Wall Street Journal has been purchased, I haven't seen too many media stories that have emerged about how he's shaping, how he's been shaping their coverage. So it seems that at least, you know, based on what I've seen, he's had hands off. So the question is, and, you know, Jeff Bezos came out after he, purchased the Washington Post and claims that he's not going to interfere with the editorial product, but you always have to wonder, like, he's going to be making key staffing decisions. We can't pretend that he can't place internal pressure that would somehow influence the coverage. Mm-hmm. There have been examples in which corporate companies have corporate overlords have caused people to back off. One of the most famous examples was ABC News a few years ago was doing an investigation, something to do with Disney World. I can't remember if it had something to do with sexual assault or what it was exactly. And ABC, which is owned by Disney, eventually dropped the story and backed off of it. So there is precedent here.
There's a famous case that the movie The Insider is based on, where 60 Minutes was set to run an interview with Brandon Williamson, tobacco executive, who was going to reveal details not then known about how they really did business. And at the time, CBS was itself up for sale, and the tobacco company threatened, I think it was tortious interference was the name of the, the legal doctrine, that if 60 Minutes got that executive to break his NDA, that could rain hellfire on their acquisition. So certainly, this is why we definitely want there to be, no one company and no one newspaper is going to be a perfect news organization and everything. And this is where we do want, there to be a wide range of, different news outlets out there. And I suppose Bezos just becomes another one. And so now we have Jeff Bezos checking Rupert Murdoch. And I don't know if that's necessarily an ideal situation, but it's certainly the one we live in now.
Yeah, and also one data point to throw in is that, when the Washington Post called Jeff Bezos for a quote in the article about his acquisition, his response was no comment. So it's right. Interesting to see that maybe there is going to be a divide between editorial if he can't even comment to, the journalist for the publication that he now...
There's a New York Times profile of Bezos from over the weekend that points out that he really never gives interviews, not that much is known about him. And it mentioned a handful of other billionaires in the technology space who would have been a lot more likely, potentially, to buy the Post. First one being, Bill and Melinda Gates, since they themselves are big philanthropists to begin with. This might, interest them more. You could see Bill Gates doing it as kind of giving back, which is, he's really kind of spent he spent his last 10 years doing that while Microsoft has, I guess, treaded water. And the other one, which was really compelling to me, I thought, was Mark Zuckerberg. Zuckerberg, before he really hit it big, one of his early mentors in business was actually Donald Graham from the Washington Post.
He spurned Graham, right? Because Graham was supposed to invest all this money in him, and then Zuckerberg last minute pulled out from the deal, and Graham let him.
Right, and it seems like they got over that. I guess in the case of Mark Zuckerberg, he was on this stratospheric rise that I guess even Donald Graham couldn't be like, well, okay, Peter Thiel could do more for him than I could here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's always interesting when somebody rich buys some kind of news publication. There's always one of two reactions. So the one reaction was when, the one side of the reaction is when Sam Zell bought the Tribune Company. Zell, he really didn't have a background in media, was not thought of as a tech visionary, and you know, we all know the travails of the Tribune Company now that's pretty much crashed and burned, and many of its newspapers are on the chopping block. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have Chris Hughes buying the New Republic.
Right.
You know, the New Republic had for a long time been on the decline, was definitely not at its zenith. Circulation was low. Its website was a mess. And here comes this co-founder of Facebook with deep pockets who buys it. And, you know, it's been about a year now since he's owned it. And I have to say, I read the New Republic all the time now, whereas before I never read it. And they are doing, they did a site redesign that's definitely more user-friendly. They're being much, you can tell that he's investing in really good journalism, really good long-form journalism. It's trying to become the New Yorker, basically, of Washington, D.C. And so, so there's this excitement about, I think it's pretty clear, or I haven't seen any reports that it's turned profitable in the first year, but I don't think he expected it to. But you kind of get the sense that if somebody could figure out how to make content pay, it would be someone like Chris Hughes. Chris Hughes. And so I would categorize Jeff Bezos on that side of the equation in terms of here's someone who has deep pockets, who's willing to invest and kind of like a long-term vision, and who has who understands how the internet works, how data works, and how you can basically monetize that. I'm pretty excited. I've talked to a few people who work in the Washington Post. I think there's pretty much a lot of optimism about this move. I think there's a lot of agreement that it's good for the long-term viability of the Washington Post.
I'll admit, I'm not terribly worried for the Washington Post. I don't think that Bezos has terrible, dark, grand designs on changing it. I actually would welcome the changes that I don't know what changes he'd make, but I would be very, very interested to see what they are. I don't think he's going to make money on them. And after the news broke that he was buying the Post, various internet wags, mostly on Twitter, all pointed out that, you know, Jeff Bezos is someone who does not mind losing money on his business. And this is reference to the fact that Amazon, for all its ubiquity, is a barely profitable company. It is, in fact, it lost $7 million on very, very large revenues. Not that it can't make money, but interestingly enough, it's choosing not to. And so,
I would amend that and say he's not interested in making money in the short term. Mm-hmm. I think he's demonstrated that. I was just reading an article in Wired or somewhere. Where whenever pressure has been put on him to make money, he has ramped up the revenue machine, and you can see that he can turn that on at any moment. I guess I don't agree with you that the Washington Post will never make money. I think there's a ton of value in content, and that we're just, you know, so many newspapers, they're just not figuring out how to utilize their content. Like, you can look at lots of examples where content companies are very profitable. Look at TechCrunch, which is, created a niche that had high CPM ad rates, but also created a conference around it, and all kinds of things, and became profitable. You look at Gawker Media. What's that?
Mm-hmm. Well, they're making money around conferences, around other things. It's like I do some work in book publishing, and you know what I always hear is that authors are not publishing books to make money; they are publishing books to raise their speakers' fees and to get involved in other projects. And I think that's probably a similar path that news organizations these days either should be going or maybe going.
And one space that a lot of news, like traditional news organizations at least, haven't gotten into, and this is something that I think ties very much to Amazon, is affiliate marketing. In the early web days for the New York Times, there was actually a negotiation with Amazon to where any time that they wrote about a book or movie, that they would link to the Amazon page for that book or movie, and any blogger who's done an Amazon affiliate knows that if somebody clicks on that link and either buys that book or continues surfing Amazon and buys some other product from it, you would get a cut of that. And the New York Times ended up backing off from that because I guess Barnes & Noble at the time, which was then still the behemoth and the king of retail publishing, was a major publisher or major advertiser in the New York Times, and so they got scared away from it.
Interesting.
But if you look at, I haven't really seen, most most major news publications are still doing standard display advertising. But I could see, you know, especially with Amazon and its history of affiliate marketing, there being some kind of integration between the Washington Post to where it's not just, you're not just doing display ads, you're doing mm-hmm. ads that actually bring you to a product on Amazon.com or some other e-commerce site and generates mm-hmm. revenue and then generates, you know, a piece of, you get money out of every one of those right. purchases.
Yeah, I mean, integration superficially, I'll just, you know, play on that one word there. You know, back again to the Amazon Web Services CIA angle to this, mm-hmm. we think about the fact that Bezos is about to, assuming that this deal goes through, which I guess from what I've read is still the most likely thing, he will be helping the CIA manage a lot of his data. And I don't believe the CIA was going to give him access to it, but it does certainly give him interest in what they're doing. That mm-hmm. combined with the fact that he, through Amazon, sells almost everything to almost everyone and more each year. I mean, has anyone really had as much integration with our lives in the way that, you know, that Jeff Bezos has now? Is there any, I mentioned before Steve Jobs, and I'd like to maybe explore that a little bit here, but is there really anybody before Jeff Bezos that has been in a position like he is? That's my question, I guess.
Yeah, certainly Google. I mean, I feel like we have so many different touch points with Google services mm-hmm. all the time, and obviously, and I think all these web companies now, they're ostensibly, so Washington Post is a media company, but YouTube is a media company. YouTube is they're not just a platform anymore. They're spending money on actually creating original content. They're giving money to YouTube stars. They're doing advertising deals with them. They're trying to become like a Netflix / network television / cable company in a lot of ways. So they're in the business of content. Mm-hmm. And then and Google, you know, does all kinds of cloud services, it does all kinds of integration with, you know, the government. It has a multi-million-dollar mm-hmm. lobbying operation. And, you know, they record every single search that we do at just about, there are just so many touch points mm-hmm. that we have with Google. So I wouldn't say that Jeff Bezos is the sole, you know, owner of our data and all these touch points
sure.
between government and our private lives and our consumer lives, I would think.
He is, however, the most interesting figure in technology since the passing of Steve Jobs. All you have to do is, if you go to Google, so there you go, I just proved your point about Google being so important. You go to Google and you type in, Jeff Bezos is the new Steve Jobs, with or without quotation marks around it, you get a plethora of results very quickly. I think it was first said by Gizmodo back in 2011, not long after the passing of Steve Jobs, where Jeff Bezos got up on stage to announce new range of Kindle products. And he was, you know, even kind of dressed similarly and also lacking hair. And that's more superficial. But just in terms of a secretive technology billionaire who is playing a long game and is working behind the scenes to create products and services that shape our world. I mean, this may be just sort of like an interesting, amusing point to discuss rather than any kind of profound statement, but you absolutely see around Jeff Bezos these days the kind of coverage that was once reserved for Steve Jobs.
Yeah, I think there are maybe two or three that are kind of, you know, these people that we're watching. There's you know, Bezos, there's, you know, Reed Hastings at Netflix.
Hastings and Netflix are interesting, but, you know, I would not ascribe to them the kind of broad, far-reaching. Like, Netflix is great, and I think its competition with HBO and television is interesting, but Amazon also does that. Amazon is in many more places than Hastings or Netflix are.
Yeah, I don't know if Hastings is quite the visionary Bezos, but I think it's amazing. Like, he basically, you look at Netflix. Netflix killed off an entire, you know, industry, which is the movie rental industry. But they didn't stop there. They just, you know, kept on adapting, and then they went after online streaming and the cable companies. And not only are they, you know, while in the mid-process of competing with the cable companies, now they're also competing with the content companies themselves. While they, and they're also, you know, still, for some people, mailing DVDs through the mail. And so in the span of, what, a decade, they are now major competitors to three different very large multi-billion-dollar industries. I think we have to give him credit for that.
Okay.
And then certainly we have to mention, you know, Sergey Brin and Larry Page. I mean, they are creating cars that drive themselves. They are creating balloons that can float for longer than any other balloon can float in the air. That will supposedly deliver free Wi-Fi to the developed world. I feel like the
with those two guys, I feel like they're throwing things against the wall to see what sticks to some extent. That, you know, it is still the case that search is there, and the search advertising is where the vast majority of their money comes from. They're very profitable. But with Bezos, certainly there's one of him, and he's in so many things. I do still think there's nobody who is in his position, as much position, to remake the world, and we haven't even got into the fact, we'll probably have to punt on this for now, the fact that, you know, they're keeping their profits very low, they're doing so on purpose, so they can, you know, dig out, and they can, Amazon wants to deliver, you know, deliver same day items. It can do that in some cases. You know, it seems like they may be trying to drive everybody else in retail out of business, which is, that's a little more concerning, and probably more than we can get into just at the moment. I did want to move on to a topic we'd also discussed, and that is ever since the Edward Snowden allegations came up earlier in the summer, and back when I first raised the idea to the folks at Blogging Heads about, you know, talking about this, that was one of my first things. And a few weeks went by before we were able to put this together, and I was afraid that, you know, maybe it would go away. It hasn't remotely gone away. In fact, just in the last couple of days, there have been a couple of major news stories in both the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post talking about, there was someone, Barton Gellman in the Washington Post wrote last week that in 2012 alone, there were nearly 3,000 breaches of NSA's privacy rules in some really ridiculous ways, in fact. One of the more amusing slash disturbing examples was where a number of phone records were intercepted because someone in the process mistook the country code for Egypt, which is 20, with the area code for Washington, D.C., which is 202. And the Wall Street Journal then also wrote that 75% of the nation's traffic, 75% of the nation's traffic is being watched, and yes, they can and do read emails, and yes, they can and do listen to phone calls. So I don't know. I mean, this is I feel like over the last couple of months, I've had a range of different opinions on both what Edward Snowden did and the situation with the NSA. I have to admit that I used to be more skeptical toward Snowden, but in the last week or so, the more that I'm hearing, you know, first of all, I'm glad that we know about these things, and my position up until maybe a week or so ago was, well, I'm glad we know about them. I'm glad he released this information, but I do want the NSA to do this kind of work. Now, while I would like to see this work done well and with greater, stricter limitations, I'm just not sure they can. Do you have any particular opinion on what we've learned lately?
Yeah, you know, we were talking about this before, where these NSA revelations are just so hard to wrap your mind around. Like, you hear, you know, there have been 3,000 breaches, and that they're collecting data on 75% of the actions on the internet. What does that even mean? That's just like so much information, and 3,000, when you're talking about 75% of the entire internet and how many billions of emails that are sent out, it's actually a very small percentage. So it's hard to put this into any context. And historically, I think we as Americans, and you know, I would have to say I'm kind of with you. I'm kind of ambivalent on a lot of this stuff. I don't know where I fall. I can sympathize with the civil libertarians, but at the same time, I can also understand some of the necessities for some of these programs. But historically, we've never confronted something like this, and I don't think there's any kind of understanding of what the NSA is doing with our data. I read a really good piece by Jill Lepore a few months ago in The New Yorker, and she wrote about kind of the history of surveillance and the first controversies that emerged relating to spying. And some of the earliest controversies, I think it was in the 1800s maybe, I'd have to reread the article, remember, but had to do with, you know, the UK, the British government opening up people's mail. And that was the first time that it ever occurred to human, you know, to the human race, like this notion of privacy and whether, you know, you feel violated if somebody looks at something that you thought was a private communication. But when you think about opening someone's mail, you think about somebody like physically opening it. You can imagine that. It feels very violating. Think about it. It feels like somebody, kind of analogous to someone breaking into your home. Whereas what we've heard described from the NSA, it sounds like for the most part, most Americans are not going to have a human set of eyes actually going through their email. They're going to have, you know, programs that are scanning their emails and scanning their browsing history. But we're already sort of used to that because, you know, Gmail scans our emails to serve as ads and stuff like that. So I think it is a very hard thing to wrap your mind about. And so it's difficult for me to form a real opinion about it.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. There's so much we don't know, and what we do know, I feel like it's largely informed by popular culture. So, you know, obviously 1984 is what keeps coming back to my mind, and I think a lot of people, and no, it's not quite like that, and no, it's not even like that in a lot of ways, but I do get this sense that we are in uncharted territory here. We don't want to get to where, you know, Orwell or Huxley were writing about the way, you know, we don't want that brave new world. So I don't know. You're right. There's a lot that we don't know here. And I was reading something just yesterday. It was really fascinating and disturbing, and also, I don't know, strange to me. Was the case of there's a woman who goes by the initials PJ. I think her name is Pamela Jones. She runs, she used to run until yesterday. She ran an IP. Intellectual property law, legal blog called Grok Law. And she had been talking with one of the executives at an email security firm that had shut down a week before. This may be familiar to viewers as well. Lovabit was the company that provided email security, and they had the choice of either complying with the NSA or going out of business, and they decided to go out of business. In their case, it made sense, because if they couldn't do what they said they were going to do, then they had to, you know, shut down or fail on their mission. So Grok Law, you know, doesn't have that same mission, but there was a very long and somewhat rambling but very heartfelt post by this woman who ran the site until yesterday, that she no longer felt that she could you know, conduct business on the internet, knowing what she knew about how she may be watched. And to my mind, this was, well, I don't know. Part of me says it's an irrational overreaction, because we need the internet to do everything else, and the likelihood that I'm being watched any one time is very low. At the same time, though, I have a hard time criticizing her concern, because if it is the case that anyone can, If the NSA can drop in and listen to us while we're recording this, you know, conversation right now, I don't even know to begin saying that I have a problem with that. I mean, I don't even know how to begin to explain my problem with that. It's very scary what it is, and I also don't want to go too far with it. So,
yeah, I guess it depends on, you know, I read her piece. I had a hard time kind of piecing together why she was shutting down the whole site. I think if you're some kind of journalist, or you're performing some kind of service in which you're dealing with highly sensitive information, that users are trusting you with, who are trusting their lives, you know, based on it, or at least their livelihood. I could see that kind of reaction. I'm not sure what kind of email she's being sent to where she didn't feel safe. If, on the other hand, she's just saying she doesn't like the fact that her email is being read, so she's just shutting down her website, that does seem a little hyperbolic and hysterical, because obviously we have to continue on functioning as adults, and part of being an adult and having a career is sending email. So I guess it's definitely these revelations. If you do work in a highly sensitive area, if you're working with maybe refugees or dissidents or people who are seeking asylum, or you know, if you're someone who has clients who are medical marijuana distributors, or somebody who definitely would be sensitive to the government monitoring their stuff, then yeah, you definitely have to listen to these revelations and start thinking, you know, what is my privacy policy so that I can protect my clients or customers? I definitely think this is something that a lot of business owners will have to be cognizant of.
Yeah, you're right. And that is a really large number of people, such that, I mean, even if you yourself don't think that you fall into one of those categories, maybe you do, and you should certainly care about those who do. So, I don't know.
I read an interesting piece about the responsibilities of journalists. So now that journalists know that this is possible, they know that there's an unprecedented crackdown on whistleblowers, that it's up to journalists to become more educated and start creating some best practices, because they kind of bear the responsibility of protecting their sources. I think it would behoove a lot of news organizations to start, if they're not already, training exercises for how to protect your sources. I remember even when I was a small town newspaper reporter in my early days, my publisher, I remember him in a meeting one week, we were talking about some potential lawsuit or something that was a libel lawsuit. I don't think it was going to be launched against us, but somebody that we had reported on. And he said, by the way, I want you guys to start shredding your notes, a month after you've made them. So, long after you would need them, that it's a good practice to shred your notes. So, it's something I think that we, now more than ever, especially now that all my notes, when I'm working on articles, all my notes are going right into Google Drive. So, it's more accessible than ever.
Yeah. Back to offline, your mention of that, as well as the Lepore piece, which I had not read, excuse me, reminds me of a piece I did read just a few days ago. It's in the latest Harper's by the novelist and nonfiction writer William Volman. So Volman's a really interesting figure, and he's best known for a series of novels, but he's also he spent a lot of time overseas. He wrote a book called An Afghanistan Picture Show about spending time with the Mujahideen in the 1980s. And he was in Bosnia, where he was in a car accident. The car was exploded. He's been very lucky he's very lucky to still be alive. He's had a fascinating life, too fascinating, in fact. Apparently, he, in the last few months, along with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is that what it's called? The EFF,
yeah.
I know it's called
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
They filed a series of FOIA suits against the CIA, to go back to them, the NSA, to go back to them, and also the FBI, to find out what was in his records. And he's also somebody who's written about the U.S.-Mexico border recently. A 1,000-page book called Imperial came out recently, and he'd been stopped at the border a few times. And so, first of all, the CIA just said, no, not going to happen. And the NSA suit is still in process of being decided, but the FBI was forced to turn over some of his records. Supposedly they have nearly 800 pages on him, and they released fewer than 300 pages. And it's a really great read, so it'll be on the web in a few days. I looked at their website. Interestingly enough, back in the mid-90s, for a time he was a suspect in the Unabomber case, where somebody had quote, or had tattled on him, to the extent that that's the appropriate way to put it, had gone to the FBI and said, hey, I should check out this William Bowman. He's kind of a curious figure. He travels overseas. He has really strong views that might be perceived as, you know, critical of authority. He's, you know, anti-government wouldn't even quite be right, but, you know, he's definitely, he's very much an odd duck, Bowman is. So he was a suspect, one of hundreds at least, in the Unabomber case until, you know, Ted Kaczynski was actually caught. And then a number of years later, following the anthrax attacks after the September 11 attacks, he was also a suspect in that too. And so I highly recommend reading this piece. I know you haven't read it yet, so there's not a whole lot to discuss with it, but I just thought it was fascinating. And this is the thing is, most of this is happening. This is mail. This is his. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have a cell phone. He doesn't use credit cards. I don't know to the extent that he uses email, but I'm guessing it's not a lot. That he did have the experience many times of having his mail from overseas delivered to him, opened, and then taped back up. And mm-hmm. over time, he's, you know, wondered about the various clicks that he's heard on phone calls. And, you know, I give him a lot of credit for being as philosophical about it as he possibly could. He feels he has something to hide. He feels that it's wrong. But it's not going to make him change what he's doing. So, you know.
Yeah, I think surveillance definitely does. Knowing that you're being surveilled changes, either consciously or unconsciously, the way that you portray yourself to the world. There was a good piece, I think This American Life did it, about Guantanamo Bay detainees, about how they're constantly monitored even when they have visitors, and how, you know, those visitors felt like, you know, at every single moment that they couldn't express their love in the way that they wanted to, that they couldn't, you know, be completely emotional, that they were always, aware of how they were being observed. Many people, you would think that most people don't know what this feeling is, but I think many of us do. The analogy I would create, or the comparison, would be with Facebook. Just about every, or a lot of people, unless you were longtime married before Facebook was invented, you've had some kind of crush, or you've gone through some kind of breakup in which you're very much aware that this other person that you were, very interested in is friends with you on Facebook, and you start realizing that every single thing that you post on Facebook, you were doing so with the awareness that that person will see it, and it starts to shape, what pictures you post, how you portray yourself, whether you're happy or sad. Back when I was in college, I went through a really bad breakup, this was before Facebook, I was a very avid live journaler, and I just reached this point where I realized that every single live journal post I was writing, I was writing with the idea that I knew that this ex-girlfriend of mine would be reading it. And eventually I caved to the pressure, and I sent out a private email to all my friends and said that I'm creating a new live journal account. I'm not going to publicly promote it, and then sending them the new URL. I don't know what it's like to be spied on by the government. But I would think that, you know, of my life experiences, that would be the most comparable.
That's interesting. And I mean, it makes me think, and we should probably wrap here in a moment, but, you know, one other thing I'd add to that is you and I both live in Washington and have for a number of years. I recall when I moved to Washington in the early 2000s, and I fairly early on began blogging. Never used LiveJournal, but I was an avid user of Blogger, anonymously at first, that anything that you say in Washington, you know, it can and may be used against you. That even if one is not serving in government, where one is a journalist, as I was an extremely low-ranking journalist at a publication that few outside of Washington have heard of, but that anyone in D.C. is a potential public figure. And, you know, I guarantee you that affected the way that I conducted myself. Not all the time, but I think, you know, in some sense, I think for the better. I don't want... The implications of that is concerning. You know, I think I behaved better, or I think that I at least, you know, portrayed myself publicly as such. And so the kind of pressure can be good, and I really, as I say that, I find myself cringing thinking that, you know, no one should have to be constantly looking over their shoulder because, you know, whose definition of good, in that case, are we serving?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. These are thorny issues, and I've had a great time conversing with you here about them. At some point in the future, hopefully, let's get back on Blogging Heads again and continue this discussion.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on.
Great. Thanks, Simon. Take care.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Bye.